This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I have the pleasure of talking to Jack Elhai about his book, The Nazi and the Psychiatrist. Subtitle is Hermann Göring, Dr. Douglas M. Kelly, and a Fatal Meeting of Minds at the End of World War II. It's really good to have you here, Jack.
Thank you, David, for inviting me to be here with you.
It's really interesting to read this book. Now, I think I'm going to guess that people who are older, like I am, remember the period after World War II when the Nuremberg trials, World War II, the events of that era were very fresh. Almost everybody I knew, somebody and their parents had, parents had been in the war, people lost family. If you're Jewish, as I am, World War II has heavy meaning. And what's interesting and in some ways remarkable is we're 80 years later, and in fact more, if you go back to the beginning of the Nazi era, which is almost 100 years ago, or actually is 100 years ago, that it still resonates. And then, of course, for many of us who feel about what's going on in the world today, resonates in some really terrible ways. But you wrote this book some time ago. It's like about,
I did.
When did you start working on it?
I started working on it in 2008, and I published an article based on the research I'd done until that point in 2011, and I published my book in 2013.
Right. So you lived with this material for a while, and then after the book was published, I get the impression, because the cover of this edition says, now the major motion picture, Nuremberg, the film has brought the book back into the public eye, I would assume.
It certainly has, in a way that it never attained when it was first published. When The Nazi and the Psychiatrist first came out, it received only one review in a publication of national U.S. distribution. And that was Science News, not exactly a literary beacon. So I'm very happy that many more people know about my book through the movie and that it's finding new readers and it has new resonance as well.
It's so interesting because, I'm in a way, I'm not surprised because, if the history of World War II isn't as resonant today, or wasn't as resonant in the, for a period of time. It was beginning to be not so much lived history. We're losing members of that generation and people's lives moving on, even though I think World War II is still actively part of our lived lives today, not in the resonance part, but actually just in the way that trauma and something of that, something that is so large in its effect on so many people traverses through generations. But in a way, it's not surprising that you had fewer readers, let's say, then, and now a film which has, a larger public presence than, your book could have had.
Yes, definitely. It's an odd experience, what you're talking about. It's an odd experience for an author to have a book, come out, make its mark, whatever it is, and then many years go by, and then because of a movie, the book makes a different mark.
Right.
And that's a wonderful opportunity for the author, and it's thrilling, but it's confusing, too, for the author. How did this happen? I've written three books since The Nazi and the Psychiatrist, and each of them is part of me in a different way, and it's a strange feeling to have that book's part of me come back to life.
Right.
I kind of like it.
Well, it gives you a chance. Now you've had some time since you did all that work and wrote the book, to come back to it in a different way. It probably, being less fresh, gives you a different perspective on it as well than you had 15 years ago when you were working on it.
Absolutely. Back then, when the book was first published, and I thought about, what are readers today going to take away from this? The whole idea of right-wing extremists involved in politics, as the Nazis were in Germany, the contemporary aspect of that seemed to me distant. You know, this, after all, was the first year of the second Obama administration. And those people seemed to me to be on the fringes of our political discourse.
That is, and you know, it's impossible not to read this book and be reminded of our own political history, because if you track back, and of course, your book is more about a period, you know, the end of World War II is, you know, and the capturing of the 75 or so leaders of the Nazis. But of course, that brings you, you know, you have to then revisit their past and how they got there. And so they go back, some of them, Goering was an early follower of,
yes,
Hitler, really, really early. So he's in there in the 20s. So you're looking at 1923 to 1940 is only 17 years.
Mm-hmm.
In the same sort of way, we have a corollary happening today, which is impossible not to think about. They're not perfect comparatives. Nothing ever is. But, you know, that great line about how history doesn't repeat, it rhymes. We are definitely in the rhyming era.
Yes, and also to that corollary, I like to add, history also gives advice. And we should keep our ears open and follow it if it seems right.
And that's one of the things that I think that makes this book important, because, again, while it's not literally the same as things that are happening here, Germany in 1920s, 30s, completely different in many, many ways than the United States in the 2015 to 25 era. But the human part of this, which is really what the book is about, are the individuals, more than the cultural forces. You know, cultural forces exist in all periods, but how individuals behave in the, in those periods is really, those are choices.
Absolutely.
And it's so interesting to think about these people. We think of them as monsters. And I think you even talk about that at the very beginning of the book, when Goering, you open with Goering being captured by the Americans, 7th Army, I think it was, that they suddenly realized he was a human being, even though they'd been fighting a war against people they knew were monstrous. Mm-hmm. So there's the difference between monster and monstrous. Demonstrated right away. He was a brilliant political person in the small p way. You know, that he was a guy who had charisma, incredible charisma, obviously, on a small scale and a large scale.
Contrary to how the British and American press portrayed Goering during the war, which was clownish, emphasizing that he was fond of fancy uniforms and all kinds of epaulets and medals. But Hermann Goering was a formidable political figure and person, as Douglas Kelly, who was the focus of my book, found out the instant he started working with Goering as a result of being called by the International Military Tribunal to be among the German defendants, and to spend time figuring them out. And what made it such an epic battle of wits between Kelly and Goering and some of the other defendants was that Kelly was a lot like Goering, also formidable, highly intelligent, charming, told jokes, all of that, and manipulative. They both manipulated each other. So I think Goering was underestimated by the Allies throughout the war, and he had his chance at this first Nuremberg trial to make a defense, not just for himself, but of Germany and Germany's conduct during the war.
Yeah, and it kind of, there's all the, I think what you talk about a lot in the book is the misunderstandings, misapprehensions of each of the people involved of the other side. So he underestimated also the Americans and the British and how the process was going to be. He had no clue. He couldn't imagine that he was being tried, you know, as a criminal, because in his self-deception, he was not.
People always ask me, why did Goering not commit suicide before arrest, as many of his colleagues at the highest levels of the Nazi government? Many of them did kill themselves. Why not Goering? And it's because Goering truly believed that he could go on to lead Germany despite the defeat in the war, and that the Allies would support him as the next leader, kind of a transitional leader for Germany. And of course, the Allies had no intention of letting anything like that happen. And that's how Goering, much to his chagrin, found himself under arrest.
And then put on trial. And I think from the Allies, you know, I think it's so interesting. This was really the first time there was ever a war trial of that kind, an international tribunal.
Yes.
So I think you talked about this in the book pretty, well, not comprehensively, but you did talk about how they were trying to figure it out. Like, how does it work when you're the victors and you're putting the losers on trial? They had to figure out the legal ramifications, justifications for doing that. So they brought in, I mean, including a U.S. Supreme Court judge, you know, a lot of really interesting people were involved there.
Yes. All with the goal of, number one, producing a trial that was, in essence, fair. This was not to be like the Soviet show trials that had taken place earlier. The defendants would have the opportunity to make a defense, hire lawyers of their own choosing, as evidence that it was fair for the most part, three of the 22 defendants in the first trial were acquitted and set free. But also more important for the Allies was that this was an opportunity to use all of the evidence they had amassed that the Germans had left behind at the end of the war to conclusively show what had happened and who was responsible. And the Allies became convinced that this was necessary for future generations to know, so that people like Goering and Rudolf Hess wouldn't become, you know, cult figures of adulation after their deaths, and a revival of Nazism to follow.
And also to show that the world could be a better place by showing how brutal, vicious, and murderous they were in violation of what we would call international standards of life. I mean, it's civilization. That was, I think, a part of this was to show just how bad it was. It wasn't just that they fought a war. They murdered civilians at a scale unknown heretofore.
Yes, and these crimes, the crimes against humanity, crimes against peace, war crimes, were not the kinds of crimes to be expected in a normal war waged in a normal way. That was the point of the trial.
Right. And of course, on some weird level, I thought about this when I was younger. I was trying to, how do you measure this out as, you know, one life against millions? The number of people who were killed by the Nazis is just astonishing. You know, it's not just Jews, it's Poles and Russians. And, you know, what I think the number is just unbelievable. You know, 20 million, 30 million people killed by them, not as a result of the war, but by them actively murdering people. It's just, how do you, the scale and scope of that is so immense. You know, the trial of one or two or three or 50 or 75 people just doesn't even measure up. You know, it's hard to figure that out, you know, kind of emotionally, spiritually.
which is one of the criticisms of the series of 13 Nuremberg trials, that not enough people were prosecuted. And there were other trials, within Germany, within Poland, other nations that occurred afterwards. But the public interest right after the war was tightly focused on these Nuremberg trials. And the Allies really wanted to make the most of the opportunity they saw before them.
Well, and just to go back to, the kind of tension point in your book, it really is about, you personalize it in a really good way. I think, your interest is in how Douglas Kelly, the psychiatrist, his role in the trial and in working with the Nazis, he wanted to study them sort of for science. But my sense was that he was brought in part not only to understand their psyches, but also to determine whether they were fit for trial. I mean, that was part of that fairness that you talked about earlier.
Yeah, that was the primary reason he was called in by the court to work among them. And that fitness for trial, it was the legal standard of fitness, not the medical standard. And that's a quite low bar. It just means that the defendant can understand the charges against him and can participate in his own defense. So that's why Kelly, realizing that he was in this extremely enviable position among psychiatrists of being in close proximity and daily contact with some of the arch criminals of the 20th century, that he should do more. And he set up for himself a more ambitious project that involved trying to identify whether these men shared a psychiatric disorder that could account for their crimes and behaviors. And that's what occupied Kelly during most of his time. Before the trial, he was with the defendants for around 4 or 5 months before the trial, and then for about 7 weeks during the trial. And that's what Kelly was focused on, and he used a battery of psychiatric assessment tools like the Rorschach inkblot test and others, and extensive interviewing of the defendants to arrive at his conclusions.
And at that time, as I think I remember this correctly, I mean, Rorschach tests were fairly innovative. I think they were started in the 1930s. So he was a practitioner who had used them and believed in them, I think, before he got to, but this is like the perfect opportunity to try to examine people. And, I guess then there's, because the Rorschach is a subjective analysis, it's hard to be certain that he, and I think later, I think you showed that it was 30 years later that those tests were re-examined and by someone farther away from the actual people. Mm-hmm. And it's very possible that the people involved in the 1940s were projecting maybe subjectively, hoping for, looking for things that may or may not have been true.
Yes, it's very important to remember that back in Douglas Kelly's time in the 1930s and 40s, the Rorschach test was used as a diagnostic tool. Kelly and his, not just him, his a lot of his colleagues would use it to determine whether someone had an illness, and if so, which one. Nowadays, the Rorschach is much less prominent, and it's not used for diagnosis. But it's what they had then. And Kelly was considered a skilled interpreter of Rorschach test results, and he prided himself in it. Now, the Rorschach tests given to the German defendants are probably the most examined Rorschachs of any set of that test in history. Many people have looked at them after Kelly gave them and gave his interpretation. And in the most recent reassessment, which was probably about 25 years ago now, the examiners, this panel of experts, mostly agreed with Kelly's interpretation, although they may not have agreed that this test should be used to diagnose, given that it was, they mostly agreed with him.
And the sense is that he was saying that the tests indicated they were not uniform. Obviously, each person was slightly different, but he did believe that they showed a certain amount of disturbance, let's say, psychopathology, but not massive.
Right. That in Kelly's interpretation, the Rorschach tests and all the interviews and other assessments he used show that these men did not share a psychiatric disorder. And in fact, none of them had a serious psychiatric disorder. They certainly shared a number of traits that contributed to their behaviors, but none of them rose to the level of serious psychiatric disorder. And Kelly put them all within the normal range of human personality, which really turned Kelly upside down, because it was contrary to what he expected. And also, it was contrary to his belief in his beloved medical specialty, psychiatry, which he thought could explain people like this. But evidently, he concluded, it couldn't. And very difficult conclusions for Kelly to come to.
And kind of interesting that it bolsters the Hannah Arendt understanding of that era as well, and she lived through it and understood it really firsthand, that these people were, as she called them, the banality of evil, that they were not psychiatric, they were not completely crazy. They were regular human beings who were capable of horrific acts. And it's, whether we believe in, the power of the cult, around the Hitler cult of personality, or the narcissism, or the attraction to power and influence and wealth, all kinds of things that we might surmise, they were not as pathological as I think they are.
And Kelly really came down on the one thing you mentioned, their quest for power, personal power, and all of the opportunities that they saw for themselves and took in the Nazi movement and later the Nazi government to exercise their yearning for power and their wish to dominate other people. That was one thing that Kelly believed was behind the behavior of the Nazi leaders. He also found that many of them were what today we'd call type A workaholics. They worked very hard and in a focused way to get what they wanted. And that many of them lacked a conscience, remorse, and empathy. And one of Kelly's colleagues at Nuremberg, a psychologist named Gustav Gilbert, who overlapped with Kelly during those months with the defendants, he came to define evil as a lack of empathy.
Which is so resonant today, because I think that we feel that that lack of empathy is in fact being repeated, by what we're seeing today politically. It does seem almost like on a daily basis, the definition of lack of empathy.
And wasn't it Defense Secretary Hegseth who criticized empathy, suggested that it wasn't useful even?
Yes. Well, we could talk about, the comparatives are right there in front of us. So whether people want to see it or not, it is in that way really, I think it's really good to read your book. But just again, to go back to Douglas Kelly, what is so interesting about him is not only that his sort of personality mirrored Goring's in some ways, obviously not to the point where he was a literal person capable of Nazism or doing what Goring did, but he was beset with personal demons as well.
And yes,
you know, it's hard to know whether the experience of being with all of those people affected his psyche, created difficulties for him. I mean, he did go on after World War II and had a really successful career. It's really sort of shocking to realize that 13 years later, he committed suicide.
Yes. Dr. Kelly's experience in Nuremberg set him on a completely different course. I don't think it was so much trauma, having been among these horrible men. I don't think that was it. I think it was more at the overturning of his thoughts about psychiatry and the realizations he came to after he returned to the U.S. and began seeing our country with different eyes. He looked at the demagogue, political demagogues in the southern states who used race to separate people very cynically at times, who advanced Jim Crow legislation and restrictive voting laws that prevented black voters from casting ballots. But he also looked at the way that those demagogues manipulated the electorate through propaganda and how that propaganda played on the emotions of the people of the South. And he saw in that a very close reflection of what he had seen in Germany. And so he began warning about this. This kind of authoritarianism can arise in the U.S. and, in fact, was there in the South already.
Oh, I think, and you know that Rachel Maddow podcast from a couple of years ago where she talked about the 1930s and the conspiracy to overturn the government even then. And so
yes.
I think, you know, that it's hard not to see the parallels that, you know, it's not like authoritarianism as a tool of power has not existed here. And it's just now coming back into the forefront in a way we've never seen before.
Mm-hmm. Other factors, however, contributed to Dr. Kelly's spiral downward. He published a book in 1947 about his experiences in Nuremberg that was very poorly received. His marriage ran into troubles. He became a heavy drinker. As I learned from his son, Doug, who is a really important source for me with this book, Kelly's children found him to be a really difficult father with overly high expectations of children. Kelly also believed he wasn't getting the professional recognition he wanted, and as a result of all of those things, he became very depressed and angry.
Right. So that part of the story is very sad. I reread some of it today in preparing to talk to you, and it's just painful. You know, and of course he did this with his children present and his wife there. It was, you know, kind of like a theatrical suicide. And, you know, the expression of anger and just unhappiness was so powerful. It's very evocative.
Yes. Yeah, to be clear, he took his own life in front of his family, standing on a landing on a long stairway in their home. And it was theatrical. That was the intent. And one of my questions that I went into my research with was to try and get at what the similarities were between this very sad suicide that Dr. Kelly made and the suicide 12 years earlier of Hermann Göring, a similar suicide because they both used cyanide to end their lives. And Göring did so, he wanted that theatricality also because he was making a statement to the Allies. Göring very much did not want to be hanged. That was the mode of execution he'd been sentenced to. He thought hanging was not for state leaders, it was for highway robbers and people like that. And he wanted to die after being shot by a firing squad, but the court would not allow that. So he took his own life just hours before he was scheduled to be executed using a cyanide capsule. And I think that common element, cyanide, contributed to the theatricality. The cyanide death is very sudden, very painful, and dramatic. And that's what both of these men decided they wanted at the end of their lives.
Yeah, it's easier in some ways to understand Goring doing that than it is to understand Douglas Kelly. Although I think about, you know, you're always sort of in your mind, you can't help yourself cast about for reasons. Why do people commit suicide? Because it's hard to understand for most people. It's not even being unsympathetic. It's just hard to understand what could drive a person to do that. It was such a final step to take. It's just, so you think about, okay, maybe what you were talking about, his suffering that he was feeling, the anger compounding over time, but also probably something to do with his family and his upbringing and what the expectations were of him that he internalized. You know, it's really, I mean, it's impossible to figure out because we can only guess.
Right. And we can only make the best, most informed guesses we can. But I think it is significant that in Dr. Kelly's suicide, the precipitating event was an argument he got into with his wife in the kitchen. And Kelly burned his hand on a hot pan. And that's what set him off and led him to run upstairs to where his home office and laboratory were to get the cyanide. So he was like a powder keg that just needed one match on the fuse. And and this came after years and years of disappointments and anger.
Yeah, that's a very sad story. But I found your book really powerful. And I haven't seen the movie, so I have no connection there. Just read the book, and I think it's really good. So,
well, thank you. The main difference between the movie and the book is that the movie covers about 18 months of Dr. Kelly's life, really centering on his time at Nuremberg. And then the book covers Kelly's entire life, including the sad final chapter, which the movie really doesn't get into.
Right. I could see that they focused on the trial, and your interest is much broader, I think, and more about him as a human being, not just about the historical moment that he found himself in.
Right. And this is why I like to tell people I'm not a historian. I never call myself a historian, even though I write a lot about history. And it's because I'm not interested. I think academic, scholarly historians have different interests than me when they write about history, that often, not always, but often they're interested in analysis, research, and explications about movements, periods in history, et cetera. My background's in journalism, and my interest is in people. There's not a person in the story I won't be interested.
Right. Well, and they are really, they're interesting people, but I think that's the talent that you bring, which is to make them interesting to others as well. You have to, you know, be interested in them in the first place, but then you have to be able to illuminate what you learn from the research. And I think you did that in the case of Kelly. He comes to life. And actually, for that matter, so does Goring. And several others. I mean, some of them are, you know, you couldn't put as much time or energy into some of those people, but Rudolf Hess is a pretty interesting character, and his story is pretty amazing also.
His story is incredible, and yeah. I wish I could have included more about Hess, but it was a little beyond the focus of mine. But, you know, here's a man who came to Nuremberg having spent years in prison in the UK before the end of the war, and he was feigning amnesia and other psychiatric problems during most of that time, and continued that into his time at Nuremberg and into the start of the trial. And so part of what Kelly was concerned with Hess is is this man really suffering from amnesia? Is he faking it? Hess eventually admitted that he was faking it, and that's why he was given a life sentence in prison at the end of the trial. But he is so interesting and deserves a book on his own. There are biographies of Rudolf Hess, and I'm sure they're fascinating.
An amazing story. Well, thank you so much for talking to me about your book. I really enjoyed it, and I hope many others will as well.
Thank you, David. I appreciated your thoughtful questions, too.
This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. I've been talking to Jack L. High about The Nazi and the Psychiatrist, Hermann Göring, Dr. Douglas M. Kelly, and A Fatal Meeting of Minds at the End of World War II. Thank you.